Hi, I'm Connie Loizis.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Happy Friday. It is October 9th, and this week has buzzed by, dominated as it was by the vice presidential debate earlier this week, where a fly seemingly chose Mike Pence's hair to lay its eggs over the course of more than 2 minutes before it toppled to the ground, an apparent victim of either viral conjunctivitis or it could have been disgust. Pence interrupted Senator Kamala Harris so much that a soundbite from Harris was immediately turned into a gif of her telling Pence, "I'm speaking, Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking," to which women across the country who have had it with that kind of business said, "Kapow." In other news, Brian Armstrong, CEO of the cryptocurrency exchange Coinbase, yesterday said in a blog post that about 5% of Coinbase's employees have accepted an exit package offered to staffers who were bothered by a policy he'd outlined in an open letter 2 weeks ago, barring political activism at work. That's not a small number. It's 60 people out of 1,200. And by Armstrong's own telling, there are still active conversations around who is staying, so the final number will almost definitely be higher. In his post yesterday, Armstrong clarified that conversations about current events related to work are permitted and that, quote, "we have just made a decision to not engage in broader activism as a company outside of our mission," end quote. But it seems a little too little, a little too late. He's already created the perception that Coinbase is not a tolerant place that welcomes diversity of opinion. I don't think there's any going back now. In the meantime, there are at least 60 people with Coinbase on their resume, some cash in their pocket, and who may be feeling spiteful, which is not good for Coinbase going forward. If I were an investor, I'd be very interested in talking to those folks in the coming months to see what they're working on.
Payments company Square announced on Thursday that it had used 1% of its total assets to buy Bitcoin. The company apparently picked up $50 million worth of the digital currency. Square believes that cryptocurrency is an instrument of economic empowerment and provides a way for the world to participate in a global monetary system, the company said. Investors and cryptocurrency enthusiasts cheered the news. Both Square's stock price and the price of Bitcoin both leaped 3% in response to Square's purchase. Cynics might wonder whether Square believes it can create more long-term shareholder value by playing the cryptocurrency markets than investing in its own business. But Square CEO Jack Dorsey believes that using Bitcoin as a global currency would lower the barrier for Dorsey's payments company to enter new markets. "The internet is going to have a native currency, so let's not wait for it to happen. Let's help it happen," he said way back in 2018. Bitcoin has been all over the map in recent years. Just this past March, amid pandemic fears, it was down to $4,944. Are we playing checkers and Jack Dorsey is playing three-dimensional chess? Stay tuned. Where she stops, nobody knows.
The Trump administration this week announced an overhaul of the H-1B visa program for high-skilled foreign workers. It will require employers to pay H-1B workers significantly higher wages, narrow the types of degrees that could qualify an applicant, and shorten the time of visas for certain contract workers. The Department of Labor and Homeland Security said the changes were necessary to protect American workers. "America's immigration laws should put American workers first," said Patrick Pizzella, the Deputy Secretary of Labor, to the Wall Street Journal. The Department of Homeland Security's rule would narrow who qualifies for H-1B visas based on their specific education. Currently, foreigners with a college degree or the equivalent amount of experience can apply to work in what is known as a specialty occupation. Under the changes, an applicant must have a college degree in the specific field in which he or she is looking to work. A software developer, for example, would not be awarded an H-1B visa if that person has a degree in electrical engineering. This is sort of funny, but true. The only exception to the rule, notes the journal, is for fashion models who are not required to have college degrees. Notably, First Lady Melania Trump, who worked as a fashion model when she first moved to the U.S. from Slovenia in 1996, was an H-1B visa recipient. Of course, some think the rule has the potential to inflict serious harm on many American companies. It's also worth noting that the policy changes have been expected since 2017, when the administration first announced their intentions to revamp the program. Whether the announcement has to do with the upcoming election, given Donald Trump's frequently antagonistic stance toward immigrants, is something we will leave for you to ponder. Up next, our conversation with Amish Jani, co-founder of First Mark Capital in New York, whose bets have included DraftKings, Riot Games, Pinterest, and Shopify, which has a $133 billion market cap at this point, having gone public in May 2015 at a much, much smaller valuation than that. In fact, it's about going public that we wanted to talk with Jani. Having watched its portfolio company DraftKings go public earlier this year through a SPAC, or a blank check company, the firm learned enough about the process that it decided to form a SPAC of its own, closing that blank check company with $360 million earlier this week. We wanted to talk with Jani about why it moved forward, what its ideal target would be, possible conflicts of interest, and whether this will be one of many SPACs, and hint, hint, we gather it will be. If you're thinking about launching your own SPAC or investing in one or just want to understand what the hell is going on, you won't want to miss this one. But first, a word from our sponsor.
The world's largest technology conference returns for its 10th edition this December, when Web Summit will take place on an all-new purpose-built platform. 2020 has led to inflection points for many industries, including the public and private markets. Are SPACs, rolling funds, and direct listings here to stay? Which asset classes will continue to appreciate into 2021? Join Mark Cuban, Fred Wilson, and Aileen Lee, as well as more than 1,000 investors on Web Summit's Investors Track, as they explore these inflection points and the state of venture in 2020 and beyond. Investors listening can reserve their place on Web Summit's Investor Track at websummit.com/strictlyVC. That's websummit.com/strictlyVC. Web Summit 2020, running December 2nd to December 4th.
Amish, thank you so much for joining us today. It's always really fun to talk to you. I want to know what you think about why SPACs are as hot as they are right now. I was talking to somebody from NPR Marketplace this week who was asking me this, and I just said, the market is hot. No one knows when the window will shut. It's a little bit of a shortcut in some ways. But what is your thinking about this?
I think there are a couple of different threads that are coming together. The first one is the possibility that it works, and it works really well. And I think that really happened with DraftKings, as Jason Robbins was probably one of the first venture-backed technology entrepreneurs to elect to do a SPAC and to break down the door. And as DraftKings went public, they obviously acquired a business, they did a PIPE. I mean, it was a fairly complicated transaction. Mm-hmm. And then of course, they use the SPAC to go public. The stock has done incredibly well. And in spite of a COVID environment where sports for a long time were off the air. So I think that really ignited the imagination that this actually could work and can be a viable alternative to the public process. I think in parallel, you had the evolution that we've had over the last 5-6 years of the private markets getting incredibly robust, where you could raise large sums of capital. And what that was doing was pushing companies that would naturally go public at a certain point in time to access the public markets and just push that timeline out fairly substantially. And so what you had were these companies that were tens of billions of dollars in value that were still sitting in the private markets. And for a variety of reasons, there's an opportunity to go public, build trust with public shareholders, to leverage the early tailwinds of growth. And so I think the combination of showing that there was an alternate to the traditional process, which we think is challenged, combined with the recognition that private companies sitting out too long in the private markets is also not a good thing, has kind of created this interest in SPACs as a unique new format to innovate and take companies public in a new innovative way that's much more aligned with the entrepreneur and much more friendly.
It's fascinating to watch. And speaking of DraftKings valuation, I think it was valued at $3 billion in the spring, and now it's at $17 billion. So it's performed really, really well. I'm just wondering, in terms of targets, what do you see as an ideal target? So as you mentioned, there are a lot of companies, a lot of so-called unicorns that are up and running, looking for a way to get public. Which of these is better equipped for a SPAC versus a traditional IPO?
Yeah, I think that really comes down to the preferences of the founder and what it is that they're looking to accomplish. You're going to have innovation in each of these areas, and the SPAC is not perfect for everyone. But I would say, you know, as a SPAC, as you're thinking about the criteria for a company, they're very similar to what you would want in a traditional IPO, because either way, the company is public on the other side of it. And so that means large markets, extremely strong management teams, companies that have an operating profile that is attractive, and a long-term margin profile that's sustainable. And to be able to articulate that, communicate that, and have the governance and infrastructure to operate in a public context, that's kind of the most important thing. And frankly, you need to be able to do that across any of these products that you use to get public.
And do you think consumer-facing businesses are better suited for this? DraftKings obviously is a consumer brand. Opendoor, the real estate company that Chamath is taking public, is consumer-facing. I'm just wondering if public market investors can better understand these businesses.
I think it comes down to the nature of the businesses, the growth characteristics of the business, the sustainability of those businesses, and then that explosive upside. And so the early businesses that are going out, as you point out, tend to be consumer, but I think there's as good of an opportunity for enterprise software companies to use a SPAC to go public. Once you have one or two of those begin to happen, that will open people's eyes to this as a good vehicle. At the end of the day, what you want is the basic characteristics of a great public company. And I think they exist, as we've seen through Snowflake's IPO. They exist on the enterprise side as well as on the consumer side with some of the names that you mentioned and things like Pinterest and others.
And Amish, so you mentioned Jason Robbins, who is involved in your SPAC. Walk us through your thinking. Why did you form a SPAC?
We're investors in DraftKings and close with Jason. And when he was initially approached, we were probably, like most folks, pretty skeptical. But as the conversations evolved and we began to understand the amount of customization and flexibility and, in fact, the nature of the conversation itself, it felt very familiar and it felt very different to the many companies that we've been on the boards of and been involved with that we've taken public in the traditional IPO process. And there was a real stark contrast. I would say the traditional IPO, innovating there was just incredibly difficult for a wide variety of reasons that we can get into. But if you wanted to change any specific term, it was almost impossible to do. And a big part of the argument back was, well, you don't want to do something the market doesn't expect, or you don't want to do anything different. The whole point of backing entrepreneurs is they do things differently, they're disruptive, they like to try different formats and really innovate. And so when we saw through the SPAC and the de-SPAC process with DraftKings that you're going through a really complex transaction, you're going through an M&A, you're raising capital alongside that, and it's all happening behind the scenes between an entrepreneur and a trusted partner, and they're coming to terms before even having to talk about all of these things very publicly, that felt like a really, really interesting avenue to create innovation. We're lead partners and directors in the companies that we're involved with. We start at the early stages at the seed and Series A, work with these entrepreneurs for over a decade. There's a high degree of trust there. And if we can step in with this product and innovate on behalf of our entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs in technology more broadly, we think there's a really great opportunity to push forward the process for how companies get public. And it wasn't happening on its own. That's just the reality. And in the short period of time that you've seen SPACs get momentum, you've all of a sudden seen direct listings come up. You've seen direct listings now with the potential to attach primary to them. So in the end, I think this was our opportunity to make a bit of a dent, to be the first to be that full stack partner from the early stages all the way into gracefully landing an entrepreneur into the public markets. And as someone that has the contextual history of building companies from the earliest stages all the way through that public company doorstep, we're a trusted partner that thinks about this as one stop in a long journey for an entrepreneur, and how can we best help them accomplish that?
Well, there's obviously a lot of VCs who are going to be listening to this and wondering if they should be doing the same thing. I did want to know, how will you manage your time? As you mentioned, these are complicated dealings. Of course, you're working with a trusted partner, ostensibly, but how will you manage your time? There's obviously lots of regulations to be dealing with. You're finding the target, you're sort of lining up the investors to begin with to raise the SPAC in the first place. Then you're also finding the investors to organize potentially a pipe deal at the end of the de-SPACing process.
Yeah. So I think we obviously were, that was one of the first things we thought about is how much of this is going to create an overhead that would distract us from our core mission. And I think every time we reflected back on it, it just turned out that the natural motion here is very consistent with everything that we do. If you think about the SPAC process, we go fundraising and we raise from investors, and that's a very natural part of the business. And you dedicate some period of time to that. And it tends to be very bursty and over a short duration. And that's very analogous here. I think as you start thinking about partnering with great entrepreneurs, that's accretive to Firstmark as a franchise across the board. And we have our early stage funds. We have our opportunity and growth stage funds where we're able to layer into our companies as well as invest in companies outside of those funds. So it's very much our day-to-day to be talking to great entrepreneurs, great teams, understanding their context and figuring out, you know, whether Firstmark might be a great fit for them and vice versa. So this felt very much part of our day-to-day motion that would be highly accretive to what we do. And obviously in the SPAC transaction, we're going to be working with a great entrepreneur and an iconic company. And of course, that accretes value throughout Firstmark. We very much think that this is part of the motion of building a full stack venture firm and the ability to service entrepreneurs. And with what we do on the platform side, it's reinforcing to those efforts. So of course, we had to take a significant amount of time up front to be able to do this the right way and to raise the capital. But I think the motions of talking to targets and finding a great company to work with is very much in line with the core mandate of Firstmark itself.
Amish, how do your LPs economically benefit from this activity? Do they benefit because it enhances your positioning as a VC firm because you're able to take companies all the way to the public markets, or is there an economic benefit?
I think our LPs benefit in a couple of ways. First of all, to the extent you're an LP and an investor in the SPAC and we're able to generate returns, you're going to do very well from that. So there's the basic element of investing. I think beyond that, as you think about what we're trying to accomplish here, if we're successful, I would imagine that more companies will begin to think about SPACs as an alternative to going public. And what we're really doing is be able to bridge this increasing gulf between capital that's raised in private markets and staying private for a long time and getting companies into the public markets when it's appropriate for them. And so, you know, what we've observed is there's been this tremendously long slide, and that's not great for the limited partner community in general, where companies are staying private 13, 14, 15 years. And you keep hearing about venture firms having to extend out lives and terms and things like that. And so if we do this the right way, I think we're going to begin to put a dent in that equation and reduce that time to being public to something that feels much more natural, which might be more like in that 8 to 10 year zone. And if we're able to accomplish that, we're going to drive liquidity into venture capital. We're going to drive transparency as these companies are public with public valuations into venture capital. And all of that benefits our LPs more broadly. And then, of course, third, and what you articulated, to the extent that we're successful here, it's going to enhance the brand, the reputation of Firstmark, the attractiveness as a partner. I mean, if you're an entrepreneur coming into our doors at the early stages, you'd love to know that the partner that you're working with can be your partner for decades ahead and has seen what this movie looks like when it's very successful. And the relationships that we forge are incredibly strong. So I think it only enhances our ability to continue to do great deals at that early stage where we come in.
I'm just also wondering, who are the investors in the SPAC? Is it the same LPs in the firm, or are these hedge funds that are looking to deploy money and obviously also potentially get their money out a lot faster than maybe a venture capital allocation?
The one thing that's, I think, a bit of a misconception is this idea that most investors in the public markets want to be hot money or fast money. There are a lot of investors that are interested in being part of a company's journey over the long horizon. And in fact, many of them have been frustrated because they've been frozen out in being able to access these companies as they stay private longer. Our investors, some are our LPs, but the vast majority are long-only funds, alternative investment managers, and people who are really excited about technology as a long-term disruptor, and it's where the world is headed, and want to be aligned with these next generation of iconic companies and want to be long-term shareholders. And so as you look at the shareholding base within DraftKings, just because the stock has done tremendously well, you still have a lot of the SPAC investors that are involved in the company and believe in the long-term opportunity that that company represents. So I think it's a slightly different class of investor in terms of their familiarity with the public markets and their mandates, but they want to be long-term holders nonetheless. And I think that's what our entrepreneurs are looking for. And the nice thing is, through the SPAC process, we're able to spend the time to get to know them and to understand that that is indeed their mandate and can be thoughtful about that process. It's really hard to do that in the traditional IPO process.
Your SPAC filing says that your firm is looking to acquire a, quote, generational technology focused on enterprise software, fundamental technology infrastructure, collaboration and workflow software, direct-to-consumer commerce, digital marketplaces, digitization of healthcare, financial technology, or gaming and consumer entertainment. What does $300 million buy you in this marketplace? How big a transaction would you be looking to make with that amount of money?
We're fortunate to have demand, and we actually upsized to the maximum we could at 360. And there was significant appetite beyond that. So the capital that we have is actually higher than the 300. But what I would say is the targets that we're looking for are going to look very similar to the kind of dilution that a great company would take going public. Think of that 15%, you know, plus or minus around that envelope. And so, you know, as you do the math on that, what it really tells you is you're looking at a company that's somewhere around $3 billion in value. You know, there's a bit of a misconception also that when you say the word acquire, it is technically an acquisition because there is a merging of entities, but you're actually just a minority investor. No different than a large private financing round. You're a minority investor. The teams that are running the business are going to continue to run the business, and you're there to support them. So, you know, what we're looking at are companies with strong operating metrics in the areas that we've been very successful in the past, and probably targeting, again, around that $3 billion valuation mark. And that could be somewhere in that 2 to 4 or 5, and you have the ability to flex up via a pipe. We're going to have conversations with a lot of different folks that we know and we know well. But that's generally what we're looking for.
Shiv, you guys talked about the promote in this case, meaning how the economics are going to work for your team.
Yeah. So ours are very standard to the typical SPAC. And I think there's been a lot of discussion around that. But we have 20% of the original founder shares. And that's a very traditional structure. As you think about venture funds and private equity firms and hedge funds, 20% is very typical. Our SPAC is very much in line with that.
And it sounds like this might be one in a series. Am I hearing you correctly?
Well, one step at a time. So, you know, I think the job is to do this really well and focus on this task. And then we'll see based on the reaction that we're getting as we talk to targets and see how the world evolves to decide on whether we do a second or third one.
Also, you know, we talked to Kevin Hartz of Eventbrite and other companies. He's obviously a serial entrepreneur, about his SPAC in August. And he mentioned that really what they want to do is find a company and then, you know, it's very hands-off, that doesn't want to actively manage the company that they're merging with, as you say. But it sounds like your SPAC, you intend to be more actively involved in the management of the target. What does that mean for a target? And does that limit the number of companies that might be interested in working with you?
The management teams of the companies that we will target will continue to run their businesses. When we talk about active involvement, it's very much consistent with how we operate as a venture firm. We're a strong partner to the entrepreneur. We are a sounding board. We help them accelerate their businesses. We give them access to resources, leveraging the FirstMark platform itself. And in that sense, I would consider us an active board member type. And when you go through the de-SPAC transaction, you look at what the existing board looks like. You look at our board and what we bring to bear there. And then you decide what makes the most sense going forward. And I think that's going to be the approach that we take as well. But we're going to be actively involved in that conversation with our entrepreneurs and here to support them in the way that makes the most sense.
Are the rules going to be any different regarding liquidating shares and lockup periods?
So those are opportunities to innovate, and that's what gets exciting. I think in the traditional process, you just kind of get told no because other people won't like it. And it's really, really difficult to push back on that. I think in this case, you're actually working with the entrepreneur in advance to figure out what's the right context. They might have a legacy shareholder that has been frustrated and they're interested in having them bought out. You might have other reasons for early investors to provide liquidity for personal needs that they have. You might want not to do any of those things and to have entirely a primary offering, but you want to give the investors the flexibility to sell out of the gate, or you might want to create performance-based locked-ups. So there's a lot of different ways that you can actually innovate in the structure once you understand the context of the company. And that's what's so exciting here is rather than a one-size-fits-all process, you can really think about what does my shareholding base look like? What does the context look like? And how do I want to structure this in a way that achieves optimal results? And it's optimal not just for the company, but also the investors that are coming in.
So have you changed anything about the standard SPAC structure, or are these just goals that you're shooting for with future SPACs?
So if you were to think about the SPAC process, the process for raising the SPAC, it was pretty typical and pretty down the middle of the fairway. When you go to the de-SPAC part of the process, there's opportunities to innovate. And that's where it's going to be very much context dependent. And we have some ideas on things that we want to do there. But obviously, we want to get to that point in time and think about it in context.
Also, Amish, this is always an issue at every stage of a company's journey, but what about signaling risk? Does it look strange if Firstmark or another VC firm is spending so much time and attention on a portfolio company versus others of its company in the same vintage, maybe a similar revenue profile?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's interesting. If you just modify SPAC to a single purpose fund or an SPV, that's something that's existed for decades now, and people have done those pretty readily. And venture capitalists have broad portfolios, and there are different points in time that you need to lean into different companies. And you're always thoughtful about how you manage your time. And there are companies that break out and require a lot of attention at that point in time. And there are companies that are much earlier stage building out their team and required effort and energy at that point in time. And so I think this is no different. You are choosing to invest in a company. And as that company needs time and attention, you'll absolutely devote it to them. And you make sure that you have the firm resources to be able to do that, just like any other private company. I think the primary difference here is just this is a structured, large, private transaction that happens to have being public on the other side of it. Now, that's a pretty big happens to have. But the way to think about that and how one spends time is very analogous to everything that we've been doing in the private company context.
Chamath Palihapitiya had an interesting tweet yesterday. It's very, very forward-looking, but he thinks more VCs should be doing this. But he also said he could see a day where there's going to be a number of VCs involved in a company, each of which have SPACs, and then they'll have to decide whose SPAC takes the company public. Does that sound like a plausible scenario to you? And if so, I guess, what would you do in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really provocative and interesting idea. You could take that further and say, maybe they'll form a syndicate of SPACs, right? The way I think about it is competition is a good thing. It's a great thing for entrepreneurship. It's a good thing overall. That is kind of what we talk about in America generally, is it's that competitive dynamic that creates innovation. So I think the fact that there might be multiple SPACs that are out there is a good thing. The fact that people may be competing for that entrepreneur's business is a good thing. And that is good for entrepreneurship fundamentally. But I'd also say that a lot of that dynamic that you're talking about already exists today. There are boards that have multiple investors on them that have the capability to write really large checks. And yet somehow they're all able to coexist, be very productive boards and highly collegial. And you always talk about this idea of coopetition. So you're cooperating a lot and you're competing at the same time. And I think that same principle, when you get to that point in time down the road, will apply because people realize this is a long game, not a short game, not a single play game. This is one where you're going to see these same investors in other circumstances and contexts. And it's really about the entrepreneur and the entrepreneur having the ability to decide what makes sense for them and people collaborating to get to the right outcome for the company.
It sounds like Firstmark would never target a company that's not in its portfolio. Is that correct?
No, that's not true. We will look at companies within our portfolio. Obviously, there's a close relationship there, but we also have a broad reach into the entrepreneurial community via our platforms. There are lots of companies where we've built close relationship with the entrepreneurs, even though we haven't invested, and maybe we made the mistake of not investing at that early stage, but have maintained a strong relationship. Our platform infrastructure has tremendous reach out into the marketplace. And so we will be looking at not only first mark companies, but companies outside of our portfolio as well.
There seems to be a smaller subset of companies that would be open to doing a SPAC. And at the same time, there's intense competition now from all of these SPACs that have been raised recently. Are you seeing that competition? Are you seeing a lot of the companies in the SPAC universe being approached? And how do you deal with that?
I think the market is actually really broad, right? We've had this big backlog of companies that are private unicorns. I think there's something like 700 plus private unicorns that are out there. And while there's a lot of headlines around the SPAC, if you think about technology focused people with deep technology backgrounds, that pool gets very, very limited very quickly. So I actually think while SPACs certainly have commanded the attention of the markets and are interesting to a lot of folks, we're still in the early days, I would actually say. And if you think about folks with deep technology experience, that's limited. And then I think as you think about institutional partners, people that are not just individuals, but have an entire firm set of resources, that gets even smaller. And then you start thinking about people who can empathize with the whole entrepreneurial journey and are there from the early days all the way through. I think that puts us in a category of one. So we're pretty excited about the ability to go have these conversations. And like we do in the private markets, we compete for deals, right? Our capital is not what differentiates us. It's our relationships, it's our portfolio, it's our platform, and we plan to do that in the SPAC market as well.
Great. Michel, it's going to be interesting to see who follows you into this brave new world.
I would call it the exciting new world. I wouldn't want the broader mission to get lost here. I mean, if we do this the right way, we're going to bring together two markets that had been dramatically diverging in the private markets and the public markets. And I think we're going to be able to reverse that trend and bring that back together. That is the classic cycle of innovation, of bringing competition, causing things to innovate and to get better. And in the end, the beneficiaries of all of these things will be the entrepreneurs who have more options in how they build their businesses and how they grow them. So I think it's a tremendously positive thing for the world.
That's great. Well, I'm excited to see companies made accessible faster to public market investors who've been shut out of a lot of these deals for far too long, in my estimation. In the meantime, I think a lot of people are going to be watching your effort with great interest, and we'll be following closely as well. Amish, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
That's it. Thanks for listening. Connie and I are off to start our own SPAC.
Yes, targeting a tech company in the Western Hemisphere, broadly speaking. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll catch you back here next week.